Southeast Asian colonial era drew to a close in 1945, there were high hopes for the newly independent states as fledgling democracies – Burma, Indonesia, Malaya, the Philippines. None stayed freed and democratic for long, and all are now in perilous positions when it comes to domestic and regional conflict. So argues journalist, close observer and resident of the region Michael Vatikiotis in a new work called Blood and Silk, Power and Conflict in Modern Southeast Asia. He says the region's broadly failed in its democratic aspirations. Too many authoritarian governments, too much inequality, despite all the economic growth, leading to a focus on pre-existing ethnic divisions. And he suggests we scuttle our somewhat romantic notions about the zone and face some inconvenient truths that it's very much in our interest to do so. Michael worked for the BBC. He was a former editor of the now defunct Far Eastern Economic Review, and he's worked as a private diplomat and conflict mediator, based in Singapore, but fairly constantly on the move. He joins us now from Phnom Penh. Hello, Michael.
Hello, how are you, Geraldine?
You say, Michael, the region is Janus-faced with a dark underside not often recognised by the West. Tell us more.
Yes, I suppose what I mean by that is that, you know, it's very easy to be lulled into a false sense of security by the patina, or rather actually more than just a sort of superficial depth of prosperity, provision of services, infrastructure, very sort of modern forms of development in Southeast Asia that have really, I think, been starting to happen when I first arrived in the region and have sort of been very much my companion on the journey through Southeast Asia. I mean, the growth of cities like Bangkok, Kuala Lumpur, Jakarta, Singapore. One pops in and out of five-star hotels, travels in relatively modern automobiles on relatively good roads, even if they're sort of, you know, jammed full of traffic. Mm. But beneath that, you know, there has always been this kind of very, very evident level of inequality, suffering to some extent, to a great extent in many places, violent conflict, and political deadlock that often leads, again, to violent conflict.
And in fact, you say that the Rohingya crisis, you believe, very disturbing actually, has the capacity to trigger some considerable turmoil that exposes all of these sort of clefts, as it were, in the societies, and that, again, hasn't dawned on us here in the West.
Well, I think that's true because, you know, Southeast Asia, what, about 620 million people, evenly divided in a way between Buddhist adherents on the mainland part of Southeast Asia, Muslims across the island parts of Southeast Asia. Indonesia, of course, is the largest Muslim country in the world. And I think that the Rohingya crisis, if it's not addressed and it is not sort of nipped in the bud in terms of developing into a sectarian conflict, spreading, for instance, anti-Muslim sentiment across the rest of Myanmar, we're already seeing in Indonesia and Malaysia very strong calls by Muslim hardliners and conservatives for Myanmar to be expelled from ASEAN. And, you know, in Indonesia, there have even been threats against Buddhist sites. And so you see that there is a kind of sense in which this could dangerously become a deeper divide for the region, making it look more like the Middle East than Southeast Asia.
Before we get back to some of the details, you say that the whole sort of temperament of ASEAN has been non-interference in each other's sovereign areas, and that this is at stake now. So a lot of the things that we've taken for granted that is seen to contribute to stability in the area, and it's obviously terribly important for Australia, you're saying this could be really a tricky moment.
Indeed. And of course, you know, ASEAN, the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, which is the regional association that covers Southeast Asia, has definitely provided for 50 years a framework for peace and security between the countries. But as the societies become more complex, as the inequality and all the other factors that I mentioned sort of bites hard, I think that we're beginning to see stresses and strains in these societies that cannot simply be ignored by neighboring countries. There is a need to collectively come together and address the threats to pluralism, to address the deep and actually growing levels of inequality between different levels of society. And yes, I mean, 50 years ago, it made sense not to interfere in one another's. These are young countries. Sovereignty is very strongly felt. And so it made sense. But now I don't think it makes sense any longer. I think it's important to take a leaf out of some of the other parts of the world, such as West Africa, for instance, where countries regularly intervene in one another's affairs to ensure stability.
You do also point out that the region is in a transition phase, geopolitically too, with Western influence waning and Chinese influence rising, but that this proximity to China is both a blessing and a curse. How so?
Well, China's rise, of course, has been evident for the last 20 years or so with the reforms initiated by Deng Xiaoping. What's happened in the last 5 to 10 years is that impact on Southeast Asia has become much more evident, not just in economic terms, but in geopolitical terms. China is busy weaving relationships with the governments of the region, closer defense and military ties, insisting on adherence to different forms of norms and values. And I think that that's been very, very much the last 10 years of this region. It's divided Southeast Asia to some extent. There are countries that would prefer to see a more closer relationship with the West, with the United States, to balance China's impinging, not just in political terms, but in social and cultural terms as well. You know, don't forget there are millions of overseas Chinese in Southeast Asia who begin to fear that China may claim, you know, their identity as Chinese rather than just belonging to the countries that they were born and grew up in and have prospered
and
in.
They'd prefer to be seen as a citizen of the region rather than of mainland China, would they?
Yes, I think by and large. Although, you know, what I've seen in the last couple of decades is, of course, assimilation is reversible. And more of the overseas Chinese, because of the opportunities in China, have actually started to rediscover their Chinese roots and see opportunity in what was their, maybe their grandparents' motherland. And so I think that there is also a bit of a reverse flow in terms of the importance of China for the region as a place for investment, as a place to trade with. You know, it's sometimes in the Western media portrayed as universally negative. It's not. China's been, I think, a tremendous source of funds, a source of stability also for Southeast Asia. It's just that right now, under this particular government in China, there is a very strong, almost bullish and aggressive realization that China's hour has come and that they are a big power like the United States. And they're going to play big power geopolitics.
And of course, you make the point that, in fact, this whole region now accounts for more private investment and wealth than Europe. Michael, if you're right about the democratisation process largely failing, which country best exemplifies this?
Well, several, and in different ways. I mean, I think Indonesia, obviously, for many people in Australia, would seem to be a successful transition from democracy, in that for 20 years now, there have been three direct elections for president. There's been two successful transfers of power under that direct election for presidency. There's no doubt that Indonesians value and consider important their democratic freedoms. The media is freer than almost anywhere else in the region. But, you know, at the same time, the forces of conservatism now stem from the increasing, I mean, democracy itself has bred its own challenges for Indonesia. Because the freer expression and the freedom to conduct politics in a more democratic way has unleashed the forces of Islamic conservatism in the sense that politicians looking for votes will plumb the sort of lowest common denominator and will often sort of go for religious conservative
as
positions.
As was the Ahok story being a classic example, for
exactly.
A former governor of Jakarta being jailed, in jail right now.
In jail right now. And that, I think, in turn, has started to alarm people. And when people are alarmed about their own security, and they will put that security above the freedom, you know, the political freedoms that they enjoy. And I think they may start to demand more protection. And that itself, I think, could encourage the security sector, you know, to sort of assert itself more. And so you can see how even a strong democratic transition like Indonesia's does breed stresses and generate stresses and strains.
And you're saying it taps a sort of latent authoritarian strand that has been somewhat quelled because things have been, of course, rather secure for many years under Suharto.
Well, it's an authoritarian strand in the sense that the behaviour of elites, I think, will veer in that direction, but also society will demand more security and start to make trade-offs, you know, which, of course, can actually, when a democracy is still young and in a fledgling state, you know, could actually mean that, you know, some of these freedoms are rolled back. So Indonesia is a very good example of a more complex set of challenges to democracy. Of course, Cambodia, Philippines even, show the emergence of authoritarian strand of leadership much more bleakly and sharply.
Which would you say is an exception then? Who would you give 10 out of 10 to?
Oh, I don't think anyone gets more than about 5.
Oh,
I mean, you know, as I quote in the book, Freedom House has still maintains that all the countries in Southeast Asia are only partially free. And I would agree with that. And of course, that in itself helps to some extent address some of the security challenges because people can feel secure and partially free. But there's still, I think, a long way to go before popular sovereignty is fully manifested in the region.
What about Malaysia, say? A lot of people, there's a huge Malaysian student population in Australia, enormous tourism back and forth. What would you say about Malaysia?
Well, Malaysia is one of the saddest cases of a country that was endowed, like Singapore, with many of the sort of the well-tried and well-designed institutions of an independent judiciary, a sort of an independent security and police force, the fact that there is a parliament that's very similar to the Westminster mother of parliaments, certainly in Malaysia, where there's a two-bench parliament. And all these sort of fine institutions, which were bequeathed in independence, seem to work quite well initially. And it, in fact, even developed a sort of a local culture of pluralistic politics. But in recent years, have come under some attack by strong leaders like Mahathir Mohamad, years in power, undermining these institutions, the independence of the judiciary, the freedom of parliament. It's easy to forget that in Malaysia, the ruling party has been in power since independence.
UMNO. Mm. And I must say, there's a lot of talk about the quiet levels, or sort of, shall we say, under the counter levels of really racism, you know, between the Malays, the Chinese, and particularly the Indian Malaysians. It's a lovely place to visit, but there's, again, there's some real undersides there.
Yes, and one of the things that I get most upset about, in a way, is the pernicious and lasting legacy of the colonial era, which endowed many of these countries with very, very divided societies, ethnically, religiously, which, of course, was the way in which the colonial powers ruled, by divide and rule. And we're seeing that today in Myanmar, very, very starkly. You know, the fact that Myanmar will methodically classify people according to race, gazetted races. I mean, to these old colonial terms, it's really shocking the extent to which that legacy survives.
And yet it wasn't really, prior to the 1600s, you point out, it wasn't actually the hallmark of this region, which was a pretty fluid, I mean, obviously there were powers, but there was quite a lot of allowance for different people to move in and out, was there not, or to live side by side with each other?
Precisely. I mean, Southeast Asia is one of the most ethnically diverse regions in the world. And of course, it's an intersection of at least three of the great religions of the world. And in the pre-colonial era, these societies enabled people to live much more closely side by side without sort of necessarily etching into their existence the sort of divisions between religions and races.
So, Michael, finally then, where are the reformers here then? Are there idealists amongst the groups and the various countries you're talking about who might dream of actually capturing the best that's possible in a less authoritarian 21st century or not?
Well, towards the end of the book, I do become a little bit more upbeat. I think that there's a great hope for civil society and for communities in Southeast Asia that are able to assert their independence from strong centralized states led by selfish elites. And I think that it's through technology of the internet, networking, crowdfunding, the ability for communities to draw closer together and also to actually use more limited resources for self-reliance. I think these are the things that are going to emerge as the points of light in terms of civil society and the assertion of popular sovereignty against the strong state.
Are there any of the wealthy people whom, you know, you see sort of travelling around the most grotesque levels of wealth, I've got to say, are any of them looking as if they might try to take the lead, which is, after all, the story of what happened in the West, really, from the 17th and 18th and 19th centuries?
Very few, unfortunately, have seen a deterioration over the decades of a number of people who are idealistic at the elite level. And as we've sort of progressed into the modern era, more and more people, they will use their expensive education simply to amass more wealth for themselves.
And to take themselves into exile and live in comfort.
And so, yes, I think it's hard for me to identify figures who are either not in jail or in positions of responsibility, you know, who could actually take forward a sort of more idealistic vision of Southeast Asia.
And I've just got to ask you before I let you go, what is a private diplomat, which is the way you describe part of your role anyway? What do you do?
Well, I work for a Swiss foundation that's dedicated to conflict resolution through using the tools of dialogue and mediation. And of course, you know, this, I think, has come about as a result of, in a way, the failings of the international system to address prolonged, protracted conflicts using either the United Nations or governments themselves. And so over the years that I've been with this organization since 2005, we've actually become quite a big player. And there are many others like us because, you know, the demand for private actors to try and mediate and
for fees,
in
obviously, you earn fees for doing this, do you?
No, I mean we're an international NGO, and we derive the project funding from, you know, governments and private individuals, but we don't demand fees for our services as such.
Very well, good. All power to you then, and so that this rather disturbing set of conclusions can be put off, maybe for a while or forever. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Geraldine. It's been a pleasure to talk to you.
And Michael's book is Blood and Silk, Power and Conflict in Modern Southeast Asia. It's a Weidenfeld and Nicholson publication. And I know we have a lot of listeners who are very well versed travelling inside and outside Southeast Asia, so I'd love to hear from you.